New Country Big Dog 95.5. It's JD in the morning. Thanks for making us a part of your Wednesday. We appreciate that. And my next guest, Allison Kugel. She has written a book called Journaling Fame, a memoir of a life unhinged and on the record. And I've been reading this book. It is tremendous. If you love reading about celebrities and covering celebrities, this is your book. And I'm telling you, there's a great message in here, too. We'll get to that here in just a second. Allison, good morning. Thanks so much for taking some time with me.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's awesome to talk with you because this book is tremendous, like I've been saying. And first of all, I want to ask, how did you ever get into the line of work of covering celebrities, the journalism end of this? How did this happen for you?
Not in the typical way. I was actually, it never occurred to me that I was a writer. It kind of snuck up on me. In my 20s, I was kind of bouncing from job to job. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And everywhere I worked, writing work was always kind of thrown at me. And people would tell me, you're a really good writer. In fact, one ex of mine said, you're a much better writer than you are a speaker. Why don't you just write everything? A friend of mine, told me at some point, he said, I've got this website called PR.com, and I'm building it up. It's going to be a newswire. And he mentioned press releases and articles. And I said to him, why don't you let me run your article section? And I've got this great idea. I can get celebrity interviews for you. And we'll use those interviews to get publicity for the website. And he said to me, have you ever done anything like that before? I said, no, I haven't. But I've lived in Los Angeles for quite a while. So I knew my way around. I knew, who to contact and what to do. And to tell you the truth, he said to me, if you can get celebrities to talk to you and get these interviews, I'll publish them. I said, okay, fair deal. And the rest is history.
And it's tremendous because of the way you interview people. I love the style that you do it because, like you say, even in the book, your claim to fame, your shtick, is that you'll ask them questions that nobody else is asking them. Because so many times in interviews, I do a lot of them too. It's just you get a list of questions sometimes from somebody, or you'll do the standard stuff because sometimes you'll be told that's all they want to do. And you just kind of talk to them and whatever comes, it seems like anyway, whatever comes up in conversation.
I took my job very seriously, first of all. So I would do a ton of research. I didn't want it to just be the cliff notes ever. So I would really research the person and I would write out some really, thought-provoking questions. So the questions that I wrote to begin with were pretty beyond the pale. I mean, they were pretty deep and not that they were, probing or invasive. Like I say in the book, that was never really my style, but they were deep and philosophical and they were meant to kind of get at the heart of who the person was. But, I would always try to drag people off script. And one way that I would do that is I would kind of open up about myself. And when I would do that, I found that the other person would just kind of almost forget that they were, doing a formal interview, and we would just get into this flow of conversation. And, I knew that I couldn't compete with the big guys like People Magazine and Us Weekly and, on the standard stuff, because a lot of times these celebrities would already offer exclusives to certain magazines and things like that. So I would have to find something that I could get that could be a soundbite or a headline that nobody else would think to ask. That way I could get around the whole, exclusive thing that they were offering to somebody else, and I could still generate shareable content. And for me, it was like, if I got to the end of an interview and I realized that all I did was stick to the questions that I wrote ahead of time, I would consider that, a flop of an interview. If I was able to really get into a zone with the person where we were just having this great conversation and it was flowing, then I would feel like it was a success.
Well, that's true. Looking at what you do, and you talk about it in the book, the extensive preparation that goes into it, it's obvious by the way you conduct an interview. And it's just it's the sign of a great interview to me has always been if you can just, it's just like a conversation, like it's not even an interview, it's just two people talking, you know.
Right. And I would, you know, the way that I formatted my interviews, it was very conversational, and oftentimes, you know, people got to know that if you did an interview with me, you couldn't say things like, well, don't quote me on that, or, oh, let me say that over again, or, because I would put that all in. You know, I would keep all of that stuff in so they knew, like, you can't, you know. So whatever you said, I was going to print the conversation. I wouldn't edit for content. I would just edit, like, for grammar and things like that.
Now, have you ever had a situation where, you know, an interview didn't go well, or you just felt like, man, and not on your end per se, but just the person you were dealing with was not exactly a great person to deal with? Like, have you ever had that kind of an experience?
Not very often, because believe it or not, you know, most of the celebrities that I spoke with were, you know, kind, gracious, down-to-earth, you know, people. Mm-hmm. But like anything else, there's always going to be some people that you don't click with. I would say Gene Simmons was very difficult to interview because he had an agenda, and his agenda was to kind of be a little bit of a male chauvinist. And so no matter what I said, no matter what I did, his thing was to kind of flip it and turn back around and try to, you know, say, oh, see, you know, all of you women always say things like this. All of you women always do things like this. And it was really grating on my nerves. And then halfway through the interview, I thought, you know what, I'm just going to roll with it because, you know, if I take myself out of the equation, the interview will be entertaining to people who are reading it. So I'm just going to kind of go along with his little shtick, as much as I can't stand the guy. And, you know, lo and behold, people said to me, oh, it was a really funny interview. I loved it. It looked like it was so much fun. But the whole time I was like white knuckling because I really just wanted to deck him, you know. Yeah.
You know, something about that doesn't surprise me with some of the stuff I've read about Gene in different interviews. Like, that's not, that wasn't even a surprise for me, for you to say that for some reason.
Yeah.
one person that I've got a friend that does movie reviews and she does a lot of interviews and stuff. And she interviewed Tommy Lee Jones, and that was the one person that she said was the toughest. She didn't say he was a jerk or anything, but she just said that was the toughest interview she's ever done. Did you have any experience with him ever?
I didn't. However, I'm not surprised that you're saying that because, you know, there are some actors or artists or, you know, whether it's a musician or an actor, there are some artists that are not really media friendly, and it's not because they're bad people. They just kind of want to do their job, and any press that they do is most likely set up by the studio or by some publicist, and it's contractually obligated, like, you're going to promote this project and this is what you're obligated to do. And you know, someone like Tommy Lee Jones, you can tell that, you know, the media stuff is probably not his bag. He probably just likes to do his film work and then go home. So I'm not surprised at all.
And it seems like, too, like, you know, even in the sports realm, because I've done that, too, you know, it's like those guys, it's kind of that same thing that you're talking about. I mean, they have to do this stuff. They don't really want to, but they have to. And sometimes that makes for a less than great experience, you know, on this side of it.
It makes for a less than great experience, you know, on both sides. You know, it's almost like you kind of feel like, you know, when you go to the dentist and you really don't want to be there, they know that you don't want to be there. It's kind of like that.
Exactly. You know, one guy who I thought was just a great story in this book was the story you told about Mike Tyson. Like, that totally blew the image of Mike Tyson out of my head. Like, I never thought that would be, you know, what Mike Tyson would be like.
It blew the experience, you know, it blew my mind too, because first of all, for years I've been trying to get an interview with Mike Tyson, and every time I would try, you know, whoever his PR rep or manager was, because it had changed, you know, over the course of those years, I kept getting the same response. You know, Mike doesn't really want to do press. He doesn't like how the media portrays him. You know, they keep wanting to write about how he was like in the 90s and that sort of thing. And that's not who he is. And he's just sick of it. So I would always get that. And then at one point, I don't know if I read a press release. Somehow I got wind of the fact that he was putting together a one-man show. And I contacted his PR rep. And I, you know, I put in a formal interview request and I said, look, I really, really would love to do this. I promise I'll do a great job, you know. And about a week later, she called me back and, you know, it was just like as easy as cake. She's like, hey, you know, do you want to talk to Mike? He'd love to talk to you. And I, it was just like after all those years of, you know, not being, being stonewalled, it was pretty cool. But I was a little, I didn't know what to expect because like everybody else, I thought he was crazy. And, you know, when I did speak to him, he definitely, you know, he's a very sweet, kind-hearted, like childlike kind of a guy. And, I have to tell you, like, he was just funny as hell. I mean, he had me laughing so hard that, like I said in the book, I mean, I know this is not professional, but I listened to that recording of the interview like over and over and over again. And I played it for friends and we were just busting a gut laughing because when he started talking about how he's this huge fan of Judy Garland and he loves listening to her sing and imitating it. And I was just like, it was funny. I mean, and you know, like he expressed a lot of remorse for things that happened in his past. Now, you know, he seems to be happily married and, you know, one thing that always sticks with me about what he said to me was he said, you know, when I had so much money, hundreds of millions of dollars, that was probably the saddest time in my life. He said, now I don't really have any money because I'm so in debt to the IRS that I'll never be rich again. But he said, this is the happiest I've ever been. So that's, I always have takeaways from different interviews and that was my takeaway from that one.
We're talking right now with Alison Kugel, author of Journaling Fame, A Memoir of a Life Unhinged and On the Record. And Alison, one thing that really struck me in your book, too, is how you talk about anxiety, because it's something that I've dealt with for a long time. I actually, you know, I take meds for it. I mean, it's a part of me and it's part of who I am. It's under control right now. But the way you describe it was just like, wow. I mean, you really, you know, I love to read things like this, and I love that you came out there and you talked about it because, you know, it's great for people that are suffering from it, you know, to read someone else that's dealing with the same things they are.
Well, that's why I wanted to write the book. This is going to sound, you know, kind of sound maybe off the reservation to some people, but I made a promise to God that I would share my story. I remember, you know, one of the many times that I was in the ER because of these, you know, out of control panic attacks that I couldn't seem to rein in. And I kept thinking that something was physically wrong with me, that I had some illness that had yet to be diagnosed. Or, you know, one of these times when I was sitting in the ER, things just seemed so bleak. I did not see a light at the end of the tunnel. That I, you know, I sat up in the bed and I said a prayer that if there would be a light at the end of the tunnel, if I could find my way out of this and be able to manage it and have a good quality of life again, that I would be very generous with my story. And I would, you know, I would not be secretive out of embarrassment, because I think that there's a lot of embarrassment and shame associated with, you know, people who have anxiety and panic and OCD and things like that, because it's sort of like, you're afraid that you're going to be looked at as incompetent or weak or socially awkward or whatever the case may be. So I said, you know, to get me out of this, I will share my story with anyone and everyone who is willing to listen or who needs my help. And it was shortly after that I got back on my feet and I just sat down at my computer and started writing.
And how therapeutic was that for you to actually write that out?
It was very therapeutic. I didn't know where I was going with it. It was like, you know, I didn't have it in chapter format. I didn't know what I was doing. And even though I was a journalist for so many years, I'd never written a book. And the idea of writing a book seemed, frankly, overwhelming. And I said, I'm just going to write. I'm just going to write a few pages a day. And it was totally therapeutic. I didn't know if it would just wind up collecting, collecting dust as like a personal journal, or if it would turn into a book. I really didn't know, but it was extremely therapeutic, and it was therapeutic to combine the two aspects of my life into one story.
Is it something that you dealt with when did it really, people are going to pick up the book and read the story, but talk about when it really came to a head for you, where you really knew that something was off, that something was going on with you.
Oh, I was 8 or 9 years old. I remember being a little kid and picking up on little things around my house because my mother had dealt with anxiety and agoraphobia, which is agoraphobia is a fear of being too far away from your comfort zone or too far away from home. So I can remember as a kid, as much as, as a parent, you try to buy things from your kids, but I can remember picking up on certain things that were going on and seeing that she was having anxiety or panic attacks or different episodes, but I didn't know what that was at that time. So I first experienced kind of seeing it in my mom, but then around the age of 8 or 9, I remember just being kind of a worrywart as a kid, to tell you the truth. I was worried a lot about any sort of physical symptoms or discomfort and things like that. And I just remember being, and I was a happy kid. I was still a regular kid, but I had this sort of inner dialogue where I worried a lot about different things. And then I remember being around 11 or 12, and I started getting these OCD patterns where I would have, like I describe it in the book, I didn't know what was going on at the time. And I thought, am I hearing voices? Am I going crazy? What's going on here? Because why am I having this silent voice that's telling me to keep checking the stove or keep checking the door or, all of these things? I didn't know what was going on. I'm like, I'm 11 or 12 years old. I don't know where this is coming from. I feel like it's not coming from me because I would never do that to myself. Does that make sense?
Totally.
So I'm thinking it's got to be somebody else. Because why would I put myself through this? And I didn't know. And it's a curious thing because now I recognize that, and I say this in the book, that, the observer of everything that the mind does is the real you, is your soul, is your spirit, is your essence. And whatever voices we have running through our mind, like a monkey beating a drum, that's the ego and that's the mind and that's all the noise. And that's where a lot of these anxieties and fears come from. But, at the time, I didn't know what any of that was. So I was just kind of in this crazy maze of confusion and fear because I didn't know how to express what I was going through. I didn't know how to explain it. I didn't know what it was. So I was scared out of my wits. Then as I got older, I became, a teenager, a young adult. I knew what it was because I had gone for therapy and I was told, well, you have anxiety and that sort of thing. And then I started, I think it was in my teen years or my early 20s, having, panic attacks from time to time. So that was the evolution of it.
And, it's crazy how it all just chains together. And then, talking about the anxiety and it's something that I've dealt with too. It's like, well, you, what do you mean? You're on the radio, or you're in front of people, or in your case, you're in front of people, you're speaking publicly, you're going in front of celebrities. How can you do that if you're anxious, if you're going through all this? And it's because you're in the zone, you're working at that time.
Sure, exactly. That's what I keep telling everybody, because people keep saying, oh, well, your job must have caused you more anxiety, or how did you do? I say, no, I say public speaking for me is as natural as breathing. And I don't know how it is for you, but I'm willing to guess that your anxiety probably does not have to do with like social anxiety or speaking with people. It probably has to do with some other aspect of life.
Right.
Would that be correct?
Yeah. It's not a it's not so much a social thing. It's just a constantly worst case scenario thing in your head. That kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, for individuals who have social anxiety and, they break out in a sweat at the thought of, giving a speech or speaking to someone who's influential or going to a crowded party, that's just as valid. That's a different type of anxiety.
And this, of course, is covered in the book as well. The book is Journaling Fame, a memoir of life unhinged and on the record. Allison Kugel is with us. And I wanted to ask you too, Allison, because, you know, you're a celebrity journalist. You've done this, you know, and you were very, very professional with the way you handled it. I want to get your thoughts on the way, it, you know, the 24/7 news cycle has gotten so huge right now that sometimes, I mean, it's almost trivial what's covered, you know, with celebrities now. And you know, there's I mean, the TMZs of the world, I'm not trying to pick on them, but it's the first one I thought of. You know, they're out there, mm-hmm. they're covering, you know, they're at LAX all the time, and they're just trying to catch these celebrities coming off the plane and just anything, you know, and almost provoking them to do stupid things. What is your take on that? How do you feel about that as a journalist yourself?
How I feel about it is it's not my thing. It's a different genre of journalism. My thing was always to profile people and bring out their humanity, and I was never into the tabloid type of journalism. You know, in fact, I was once assigned to do a story for Us Weekly, and not that they're a bad magazine, but I remember going to a party and I was doing some red carpet stuff. Like, even though I was mostly like an in-depth profiler, but I did this on the red carpet, on the stuff for this one assignment, and there was one young actress, fairly well-known actress, and she'd had a little too much to drink, and she told me that she, put Botox in her face. And then she said, "Oh my God, I can't believe that just slipped out. Please don't print that." And when I turned in my report to Us Weekly, I omitted, you know, kind of all the, like, you know, the juicy stuff. And I turned in a fairly boring report, and they never called me again. And I think, you know, like that kind of gotcha journalism is really not my thing. It just wasn't what I did. I think that in some ways I was kind of a misfit in the way that I ran my career, because, like I said, I only did in-depth profiles. You know, I don't have anything against the tabloids. You know, I just did a tabloid in the UK just did a story on me to promote my book, and I'm thankful, you know, for it. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, rag on anybody. It was just never my thing. It's just not something that I would feel good about or what I would feel comfortable doing personally.
It seems too like, you know, truth be damned or facts be damned a lot of times with those things. And again, you know, I'm not picking on anybody, just like you said, in particular, but just for example, just 2 days ago with Aaron Moran passing away, you know, all of a sudden, you know, everybody's talking about it's an overdose, and this person's saying this and this person's saying that, and all of a sudden it comes out yesterday, no, it was cancer, you know. So, I mean, that kind of thing just kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth if you're truly a journalist, you know.
Yeah, I don't like that kind of thing. I don't like anything that degrades or humiliates anybody, especially somebody who has passed away. That's certainly never something that I would do, you know, as a journalist. And yeah, I don't like anything that is degrading or humiliating or inhumane, because I think that sometimes, you know, we forget, and sometimes I'm guilty of it myself. I mean, like, look, sometimes I'll be at the supermarket, I'll pick up one of these magazines. You know, I've had a stressful day. I feel like taking my mind off my own, you know, crap. And I just feel like, you know, reading about somebody else's, you know, mishigas, as we say in Yiddish. And, you know, I think we're all guilty, but sometimes, I mean, even, you know, it's human nature even to gossip. I mean, who doesn't gossip every now and then? But I think that we need to catch ourselves. You know, I listen to Joel Osteen a lot, the pastor, and I listen to his sermons, and I think they're really important for me because they kind of keep me on track. And he gave this sermon once where he said, you know, try to behave from your higher self. You know, it's, you know, obviously we all have a tendency sometimes, you know, you hear something about someone and you kind of, your first instinct is to kind of join in and say, yeah, I don't like that about that person either. But instead, you know, don't add fuel to the fire. Rise above it. So that's what I think we should all try to do. But I think that at the same time, the 24-hour news cycle puts journalists under a great deal of pressure to fill up that 24-hour news cycle with content at any cost, and to also be first. Instead of being right, just be first. Get those extra clicks, get those extra views at any cost, even if it's at the cost of another human life. You know, we kind of separate ourselves from it, and we don't have empathy for, you know, for that other person as a human being. And I think that we should think twice before engaging in that behavior.
Tremendous.